You are listening to National Security Law Today.
Welcome to National Security Law Today, the podcast of the ABA's Standing Committee on Law and National Security. I'm Elisa Poteet. We're glad you're here. Now, in the movies, a protected national treasure looks something like the Holy Grail, maybe the Ark of the Covenant, or the nuclear codes, or maybe the name of a deeply embedded human source, or it could be the scientific formula for a toxic biopathogen. You know, in reality, does a national treasure actually look like ones and zeros and lines of code? Does it look like every search you've ever made on Google? Every social media post you viewed, liked, hovered over? Does it look like your medical data, that private information that you entered into a medical records site so you could transfer your records from one doctor to the next? Does it look like everything you've purchased, hovered over, thought about while online? Does it look like the secret contents of your brain, your DNA that you so easily turned over to a company you found online after seeing its upbeat friendly ads because you hope to trace your roots? And could all that data, your data, be assembled with other people's data and be assembled by our enemies and weaponized in such a way that it creates a threat to our national security? And how do you create or dig a moat around the data? How do you build a fortress to protect it from algorithmic menace by our enemies? And is this national security threat too complex and subtle for Congress to understand, address, and explain to constituents? And does the U.S. economy and tech industry depend on the commercialization of our data so much that to protect it would actually threaten the current data-dependent economic model on which Google, Meta, Amazon, Apple, and the entire U.S. economy depend? And who can simplify these issues for members of Congress, most of whom lack any technical knowledge? Well, one guy's trying to do this, and that's Brandon Pugh, a policy director and resident fellow for cybersecurity and emerging threats at the R Street Institute, a think tank in Washington, D.C. Here, he's also a national security law professor in the military, but he's here like everyone else that we have on in his individual capacity. So I thought we'd bring him in and talk to him tonight. Hey, Brandon.
Glad to be here. I mean, with a lead in like that, I feel like I need to say something very astounding, but it's
well, maybe you will. Maybe you will. You know, what's not astounding to you, maybe astounding to most other people, but let's go back. Obviously, I tried to paint a very serious picture here because I do mean it. Why do we care about our personal data in the first place? And why should we see it as a national security treasure when a lot of people say, who cares if the Chinese get my dance videos on TikTok?
Great question. I mean, it's really good to be here and glad that you're focusing on privacy specifically. But to your point, data is too oftentimes seen largely as a consumer issue. And whether it's knowing your shopping habits online, what you're buying, or some people say, well, I have nothing to hide in my life. So what do I care about who has my data? I mean, if you're like me, I would say there's privacy implications just in that. Like, I'm not like a paranoid person, but I don't want the average person knowing what I'm buying online. But in reality, it's even, you know, significantly more worrisome than that. Like, when it comes to sensitive data, whether it be your health data, your geolocation data, genetic data. But then increasingly concerning is who that's being transferred to and used by. Is it a foreign adversary? Is it a criminal group? Or, you know, on the opposite extreme, maybe it's just a U.S. company that you want to use your data. So it really matters between the type of data and who's leveraging it. You know, even aggregated data matters. So even if, you know, you're in a sea of data with tons of other people, technology is great, but also one of the concerns is it's allowing inferences and people to be better targeted now based on large data sets. Happy to get into that. You know, unfortunately,
let's break this down. I mean, yeah, data aggregation may not be understood by everybody, but just give us sort of like a rudimentary sense of what this means and what the value of it is for purposes of target advertising.
Yeah, I think there's a few things. I mean, at a high level, I think as an outset, data in itself is really important. You know, we need it for national security purposes. You know, our DOD and our intelligence community leverages it all the time. So I think it really is having a healthy balance between legitimate uses, both by the government and the private industry, but combating against some nefarious purposes, maybe, you know, the less positive actors among the private sector, or by adversaries. But specifically to your point, you know, it's a question of like, if there is a sea of data, how do we make sense of that? Is there the ability to determine who may be an intelligence asset, who may be a senior ranking in the military, who's an elected official, and then targeting them accordingly? And that's unfortunately been done for many years. And we have, you know, many examples of that. But, you know, the advent of technology, you know, AI is just is one example of how AI is allowing some of these inferences to be drawn significantly quicker and easier. The flip side of that is there's many ways that AI is going to protect privacy. So it's equally as important to leverage it for its positives. But we have to be mindful of potentially, you know, how bad actors are going to leverage the tech to do what they're already doing, but significantly quicker and easier.
Let's go back for just 2 seconds here. I jumped ahead to, you know, what is this data aggregation? But I think the breakdown is that supposedly it's anonymized, like there's some random number assigned to any individual behind the keyboard. And that gives a profile of who the person is based on their viewing, shopping habits, and other data that may be accidentally given over to Apple, Google, whoever, because you do agree to give over a lot of stuff, or any app developer for that matter, including location data. So I would think with respect to certainly anybody in the IC, they should get into their phones and turn off all the location data on all their applications. That's the first thing. But this information is then sold to advertisers who target us with ads. And that's basically how we get this so-called free service from Google, Facebook, et cetera, is we're the product. But then the bulk data, the idea of bulk data is sort of that which we are as a collective community, right?
Yes. No, there's a lot to unpack there. I think starting maybe with the ad side first, you're right. Nothing is really free. So I always tell people, like, when you're getting a free app, yes, there are some exceptions to this, but some of them are largely just an agreement for you to let them use your data and make inferences for it or target products for you. I mean, there are maybe some legitimate free ones, but you're usually giving something up. And then unfortunately, a lot of times you're agreeing to it. You're clicking that I consent the privacy policy. And even, you know, a lot of listeners being attorneys, how many of us actually read that privacy policy? I know I used to for fun, but now I've largely stopped because it's just, you know, there are hundreds of pages long.
Well, it would be all you ever did, right?
Exactly.
For the rest of your life.
100%. No, but you're right. I mean, the modern day ad ecosystem, like there are important purposes for it. I mean, and one side, it's a way to get more products that are better aligned to you, and you're going to see the ads either way. So would you rather see something you'd want to buy? And it's also a way to like help small businesses get their products out or measure the effectiveness of ads. So those are all positives. You know, we have seen some negative uses as well. I mean, the Federal Trade Commission over the past few years has taken a number of enforcement actions and a number of investigations around it. I mean, on one side, we saw, you know, a healthcare platform selling sensitive health data to an advertiser to therefore sell medical supplies. And that was not being done in full transparency. But that's just, you know, one example. But in terms of how it works, you're right. Without going super technical, essentially, I like to think of it as it's a unique ID as attached to your device. Like think of a phone. And that helps advertisers personalize offers to you as you move across different sites. Yeah, it's a little more nuanced than that, but that's essentially what it is. And there are a lot of positive privacy developments. You named a couple of them. Like consumers have more choice now than they've had maybe 5-10 years ago. But it's a matter of letting consumers know about what their options are, like, can they opt out? Do they have to opt in from the first place? And then getting them to actually do it. So that's always a barrier. I think to me, what's really encouraging is there are some big players in the space that are kind of moving away from the use of advertising IDs and, you know, other ways to track people into more proactive measures to make it harder to identify the individual and maintain that data. Perhaps not foolproof, but I think it's a little better than where we've been, given some of the national security ramifications that can result when adversaries get a hold of this data.
I think that there is skepticism that a foreign government can really make use of this data, but they can. Do you want to talk about some of the ways in which they can make use of the data and what this might look like? Part two of this would be, what might this look like in the run-up to the elections?
100%. Yeah, this isn't just, unfortunately, theoretical anymore. We've seen this risk flagged in a number of U.S. policy documents over the year. Just for anybody that's listening, like the National Cybersecurity Strategy flagged this, the annual threat assessment, the intelligence community flagged it, numerous White House documents, but that largely has not led to concrete action until recently, which, you know, I'm sure we'll get into, but that's the unfortunate reality. I think what one of the recent White House executive orders did well recently was took a lot of discrete statements around how adversaries may leverage this data and firmly put it in one place under in a White House executive order. You know, so we do see the ability to target specific individuals, whether they be members of the military, the intelligence community, people with specific views, and also just our kids. You know, there's on one hand, you may be looking for this data to blackmail them or commit espionage for strategic gain. You know, long term, if there was ever a military conflict, having this data on hand and readily available, not to just identify those groups that I flagged before, but also to proactively have profiles and know about certain Americans and certain trends. It's also making traditional methods and attacks more effective, especially in the cyber domain. We've seen that. But in terms of like, you know, some people will downplay that saying like, is China actually doing that? Like, we know they're doing it in their own citizens. I think it's, you know, relevant to point out how it's playing out in two current conflicts, maybe not with China, but maybe the application. In Russia, Ukraine, for instance, you know, we saw members of the, granted both sides, but specifically on Ukraine, information being collected on members of the military. And that was for more effective disinformation campaigns. We saw more targeted messaging saying, lay down your weapons. Like Russia was actually having more advances than they were. We also saw physical violence threats using publicly available information and data that the Russian government is scraping from social media and purchasing in certain cases. It was leading to threats of physical violence. So that's just not a theoretical. It really shows how data can be, you know, manipulated and used by adversaries. And similar applications are being seen currently between, you know, Israel and Palestine, unfortunately.
I mean, it seems to me, why wouldn't you also be able to run an AI tool against a data set and ascertain who in there might be sympathetic to your position as Russia, or who might be on a dating app who happened to work or did work in the IC and might have access to classified information? And unfortunately, I've noticed that no matter what age or how you look, many of these men believe, you know, that these always young, always very attractive Russian/Asian women really are interested in them. And they begin these, like, they get sucked into it quite easily, but they were profiled to begin with, quite obviously. But if you think of that on a massive scale, I guess what I'm imagining is a situation where you could decide which candidate is more favorable to your side of a war. And then you could begin to target people that you thought might be susceptible to influence and try to get them over to the side of that candidate with the view that if that candidate wins, you get to win your war because the U.S. would be necessarily less involved.
Yeah, you raise one way that people are getting that data, which is leveraging another human. That's certainly a risk, and that's concerning. But I think even more concerning is just the amount of data people are freely giving up there now and what's already out there. So not to say they're not going to continue to utilize other methods, but it's essentially a low cost to engage here. I mean, for instance, there's been some few studies that show as low as a penny, you can identify, you know, certain characteristics that may lead you to believe somebody is a member of the military. I mean, to your point on being able to target information, micro-targeting is a big issue, you know, not to shamelessly self-promote, but the Army Cyber Institute in conjunction with the Secret Service, you know, a few months ago did a fantastic report on micro-targeting, essentially, you know, collecting information, analyzing that data, and then creating specific messages around that, often targeted toward high-valued individuals, but certainly can be applied in the election context. So I think that's the concern, is there's just so much data out there. And unless we take proactive steps to get ahead of, you know, some people say it's a lost cause. There's just so much out there. There is a lot out there, but does that mean we do nothing then moving forward, then take proactive steps to combat what's already out there and protect it? I would say it's better to do something now than just to say, well, it's too late and not do anything.
Yes, I don't know that it's too late, but I believe one of our guests pointed out that in one election year, over $67 million was given to members of Congress or PACs in the run-up to the election by big tech, with the idea that it would sort of stymie them, keep them from getting involved in any privacy legislation that would upend their business model. You know, I don't know what prevents anyone from taking this on, but I think it's really a cop-out to say a problem's too big. When have Americans ever shied from a problem too big? That's just not American. That's not how we are. That's not how we've been. And we've tackled big things well since our forming.
100%. And so many times people focus just on the government's use of data and the government's collection of data individuals. That's certainly relevant and important, but like, we also have to keep in mind how it's being used on the corporate side as well, in terms of how data is being collected, how it's being accessed, transferred, protected, equally as important. And right now, outside of just voluntary commitments, just some sectoral privacy laws like your HIPAA and your GLBA in the finance section, and then some state privacy laws, largely there's nothing on the books. Yes, agencies can take ad hoc enforcement actions, and they will continue to do that, like the FTC, but there's not a, you know, a broad federal law to point to. And I think that's part of the challenge. I mean, I think, you know, there's definitely mixed views in industry. I would say most industries actually favor a comprehensive privacy law now, one that would include security. But the actual substance is maybe where there's some disagreement in terms of, you know, how do we get agreement to some of the controversial provisions that may have more impact on some members of industry in certain cases than others. And, you know, advertising is obviously a really key area to focus on because, you know, one hand, you want to have privacy protections around it. But on the other hand, it could change some of the business model and practices of that companies have relied on for many years.
I can't really imagine a guy like Benioff agreeing to any of this, and I'm sure that he would be opposed to it. In fairness to industry, we've grown dependent. The economy has grown. I mean, look, you know, Apple and NVIDIA as of today, these are the most valued companies in the world. They depend heavily on the revenue that is generated from the data that they collect from users of their devices, platforms, and services. I mean, I just don't know how a federal law is going to jump into this economic system and prevent the collection of the, I see why the EO prevented like the bulk transfer of data, but I just don't know how we regulate this. For a second, let's talk about like GDPR, the general data protection regulations that the EU came up with. I think it was easy for them to do that for one reason. They don't have any of these companies. There are just none of them within the boundaries of Europe. I mean, is that right? Is there anything over there I'm not thinking of?
Yeah, I think that there is definitely a difference, though, at a high level between how the EU and the US approaches tech legislation and regulation, and there's sharp differences. I think there's more appetite to have more aggressive regulation in the EU than in the US. And that's just broadly speaking, even outside of like the current privacy legislation. I'm often asked, like, would the GDPR be a good privacy bill just to wholesale implement in the US? And, you know, there's definitely good parts of it, but I also think there's concerning parts. And I don't think there'd be the political appetite to hear to act on it. And I think that really underscores the challenge of getting a federal law across the finish line. I think that it's more paramount now than ever, especially in the AI age. But getting agreement on some of the more controversial parts is hard because on one hand, you're going to have maybe industry say certain provisions need to be changed. It's going to impact their business and, you know, hurt innovation, which I'm 100% sympathetic to. On the other hand, you're going to hear a lot of civil society groups saying it's just the opposite, that it hasn't gone far enough. So how do you try to bring these two groups together and try to find a middle ground or perhaps give and take to, you know, give some organizations to the other? And that's certainly hard. I mean, I've been following this now for many years and trying to find a middle ground. And I think there's definitely a path forward. It's just a question, is there the political will, I think, to do that? And there's, you know, a variety of provisions that stand out as the most controversial, which, you know, I'm happy to expand upon. But I just hope we're not in a situation 10 years from now still talking about a privacy law because, you know, 10 years ago we were. So there's been a lot of positive movement in between. But on the privacy law, very few people actually see it in a security context or a national security. They purely see it in this consumer privacy play, which I think is...
I mean, is that true now, even after the issues vis-a-vis, you know, targeting by Cambridge Analytica and all that stuff? Do you see that in your conversations with people that they still only see it as consumers?
Well, maybe I overstated it slightly. I would say it's predominantly consumer focused. And if you hear a lot of the disagreements, it's usually in the consumer realm. I would say last year, the House of Representatives considered it in the security side, maybe one, two times. On the Senate side this year, we've seen it maybe we had one hearing not too long ago looking specifically at the security implications of privacy and like actions around data minimization. But the last substantive time I can recall being discussed was around a hearing I testified in, kind of looking around how China is leveraging and utilizing this data. I'm sure there's been discrete mentions since, but I think that's really the big issue and why, you know, regardless of party, people should rally behind this because it's important for us to protect consumers' data and give them the rights. But I think taking proactive measures to prevent this from getting in the hands of adversaries is really important because that the executive order you referenced, that's an important step. But and I think the White House would even admit this. It's only a partial solution, not saying that means we don't do it, but it still leaves a lot of implications around data being left unaddressed. I think that's the reason we saw the White House and President Biden actually say, actually, that we're calling on Congress to pass a national privacy law because that will help address other aspects that this executive order doesn't get to. And that's not new. You know, during the President's State of the Union, he said the same thing.
Yeah, I mean, I guess the question that I have is, let's say the, you know, one side of the issue or one side of any potential legislation would be, the banner for that would be carried by civil society groups, but they're up against the lobbying behemoth of big tech. I mean, I just don't see them winning in this. I see big tech taking the prize. I think, you know, it's going to take a strong commander in chief and maybe some, you know, strength of character out of members of Congress to say, hey, you guys are great. You've contributed well to the U.S. economy. Everybody loves you. You know, terrific. Thank you so much for your technological development. But, you know, we got to protect our people here. And this has just gone too far.
We also need to keep in mind, though, some of the worst abusers of data are actually small companies. A specific example are data brokers. And not all data brokers are bad. Let me preface that. But we do have many small data brokers that in some cases are one or two employees, but are harvesting super sensitive data on Americans. So equally as important, we want to go after those types of individuals and not just have a privacy law be just applicable to our largest companies, which I think sometimes there's that temptation to do, even among members of Congress. And we've seen some state legislatures go in that direction. So I think it is a healthy balance. And I do think there is a discussion draft underway in Congress, the American Privacy Rights Act, APRA. There's mixed feelings on it, even by members and civil society and industry. It has, I think, solid compromises in some areas, but industry would want further changes as well as civil society. And sometimes they're for the same exact provisions, which makes it a little challenging to try to move ahead. And that's kind of where my team and my work is really how do we thread the needle and try to not harm either group and try to find a middle ground and have consensus. And I think that's kind of the aim of the sponsors as well, both the House and the Senate sponsors, is try to have a middle ground. And we have to notice, though, it is a Democrat chair and a Republican chair working together on this draft. That's notable in itself. And I think there has been a path forward. Even if it doesn't pass, it's continued progress. And I think they're committed to seeing it pass. I think to your point, though, it has a long road ahead. And there are some large concerns out there among industry specifically, as well as I hear lesser from civil society. So I guess time will tell. But it did pass out of a subcommittee. And it's, you know, all rumored to potentially have a full committee markup in June. So just this month. We'll see if that actually happens. Time's ticking with the election.
Yeah, well, solo on that. And, you know, we'll have to circle back to you if it makes some progress. You've seen it. What does it look like? What are some of the key provisions and what stands out to you in your mind as being successes in terms of the terms of the bill?
Yeah, just so at a high level, people aren't following this. Essentially, this will be the federal standard for how data is collected, how it's transferred, how it's sold, what consumer rights you have. Then it also, you know, has some obligations on companies as well, you know, around security, minimizing the amount of data that's collected in the first place. And then obviously there's enforcement sections as well. So there's a lot there. This is an extremely dense bill. It's actually a still discussion draft. So it largely built on the bill that moved forward last Congress with some notable changes. That's kind of where things have gone, has passed out of the subcommittee. In terms of, like, there's a lot of positives in the bill. I think there are areas that are worth to continue to look for. But I would say in terms of the most controversial, that's kind of what people like to always hear. You know, one is around preemption. This is not new for people that have been following this and listening. As we sit here, I always have to check my clock because it seems like a new state privacy law is passing by the minute. And that's not actually an exaggeration sometimes.
It does seem that way. I'm with you on that.
It's crazy. But, you know, we have anywhere, let's just take of argument, 16 to 18 state privacy laws. So essentially, if there's a federal law that passes today, what happens to those state laws in the books? And there's different types of preemption, not to put my law professor hat on, but just really simply put, you know, would the federal law replace those state laws so they could be no longer? Or on the opposite extreme, could those state laws continue and the federal law would be the floor and states can make it stricter? Or is there room for some middle ground, essentially have preemption and have some carve outs with continued state action? This bill has strong preemption. Essentially, no state's privacy laws could continue. The caveat, which is where I see largely some trade associations industry being concerned about, is it's not full preemption in the sense of there are carve outs for states to continue to act. The countering argument to that would be, yes, there's carve-outs, but those are largely areas not encompassed by this federal bill. And those states have dozens, in some cases, of years of experience. Give an example for any criminal practitioners listening. You know, it would preserve criminal laws that connect to privacy. But whereas this federal law does not govern that. So that is kind of the thinking behind it. I agree. I would not want to see a law, just personally speaking, that is not fully preemptive, because then we could have a scenario where we have 51 privacy laws. And are we that much better in terms of a ease and compliance perspective? Yes, maybe consumers be benefited, but it would also harm industry having to follow 51 frameworks. I'm very sympathetic to that. And that's a challenge. Enforcement's also challenging.
Yeah. Who's going to own that?
Yeah. So as it stands, it's kind of a three-leg stool, if you will. One is the Federal Trade Commission. So they will be an enforcer. State attorney generals will be an enforcer. The third is the most controversial. It does have a private right of action. So individuals could directly sue for violations. It is limited in the sense it doesn't apply to every provision, but it is much broader than any of the state privacy laws we have now. Matter of fact, most of them don't even have one. That is the most controversial. You know, on one hand, some will say this is just going to be abused and just as a way to create litigation and to make money. On the other hand, people will say, especially among civil society, this is really important to vindicate your rights. You know, it just impacts you. And maybe it's not big enough to be of interest to an enforcer. I mean, I kind of fall in the camp that I agree. I wouldn't want to see a private right of action exploited. And perhaps I would not actually want one. But I do think it goes back to the need to have compromise. If we ever want to actually see a federal privacy law pass, there are certain sticking points that I just don't see not having in there. And maybe I'll be wrong, but historically, a private right of action has been one that, even modified or restricted, is one where more progressive and civil society want to have in there. That's a challenge. Yeah. And that's kind of one of the sticking points now.
I rarely take the side of an industry in this situation, but I would say that when I look at the number of lawsuits brought in court in California under the California Internet Privacy Act, CIPA is the acronym, just like the Classified Information Procedures Act, same acronym. So I get a dump of that stuff. I mean, it seems like somebody sues over a violation of privacy, and some of these things sound incredibly legit, like they're continuing to collect on a person's camera, for example, or, you know, without them knowing, or somebody's closed their account and they continue to collect data from their device or whatever it may be. But there are a lot of things in there that look a little suspicious. Like you see sometimes the name of the same litigant popping up here and there, maybe twice, three times, and they're not associated with one of the few august plaintiffs firms that would be probably good stewards of a lawsuit like this. So maybe that's a legitimate complaint, and maybe they're looking at how this unfolded in California.
Yeah, I think it's a valid point. In an ideal world, I probably wouldn't have a privacy law with a private right of action. That's, I would say, it has historically been one of the trade-offs for preemption, realizing that this is just overgeneralizing, but it's kind of true. Largely, industry has wanted preemption, so they have one standard to comply with. And that's one of the reasons, even coming from a free market think tank, some people would say, well, why in the world would you want a federal law? That is regulation. However, I am, you know, concerned with the number of state laws that have been popping up and how key differences are emerging. That's a nightmare, especially for small and medium-sized businesses. And does it actually help consumers? Because most aren't protected.
Yeah, and there's no way to bring like a Commerce Clause claim by somehow aggregating or quilting together these disparate state things and challenging them. Like, there's no mechanism here to say, hey, this isn't working. We need something cohesive. Once again, everybody's depending on Congress, but I think the reason we ended up with an executive order is they've had, what, 47, by my estimate, hearings at this point. And this seems like the first time I've heard of some kind of at least a stab in the direction of comprehensive legislation.
Well, you're right. So last Congress, we had the American Data Privacy and Protection Act, and that actually passed out of the full committee by a 53-2 vote, but it kind of stalled from there. There were certain elements that kind of caused it to slow down, and that did not have the support of the Senate chair, notably. So that's why a lot of people were really seeing this as promising, because the two chairs came together. The question now will be, though, is, you know, it's an election year. There's limited time left this Congress. Does timing even permit it? Second, is it a political will to actually allow this? And then third, there are a lot of concerns with this discussion draft on both sides of the ground. So, like, will people come around saying this is the time to act? And if we don't get it, we may not. Do we hold off for another Congress or another 10 years? I would say, like, there's definitely room to continue to fine tune it. And I think the sponsors have been willing to do that. In terms of your point on the White House action, I don't know. I don't want to overspeak for the White House, but my understanding from their work has been that they don't see it as a substitute. And they've been very clear to say the executive order is national security focused. Part of that is for the legal authority to try to put it under IEPA.
Right, under Article 2. Mm-hmm.
Exactly. But then they've also been clear that this should not be read as a broader privacy measure or, you know, impact on data flows, even though it does, you know, it does impact data flows, but not from a like transatlantic traditional notion around that. And that's one of the reasons they called on Congress, because I think the executive has gotten some severe pushback from trying to do a little more on privacy. I think the example that comes to mind is the Federal Trade Commission. They tried to do either a 94 or 95 question rulemaking, I think 95, around privacy, and it was very expansive. And it got into areas that arguably the executive did not have the authority to do, so they kind of abandoned it. The argument was, well, we have nothing else in the book, so why don't we just do a rulemaking? And that's one of the reasons I think that many look to Congress to say, well, you know, we need Congress to dictate the policy here. The executive can only do so much. And if you are concerned about executive branch overreach, maybe that makes sense then for Congress to act, because then they're clearly delineating where they want agencies to act. So, yeah, I think the White House did some decent messaging around that from the start, saying this isn't a substitute. And quite frankly, you know, there's only one avenue of how adversaries are getting data. Yes, they are buying it from data brokers, not all data brokers, but some nefarious ones for sure. But they're still going to steal it. They're still going to rely on buying companies that have it. They're still going to buy it from the ad ecosystem. So there's a variety of ways. And if we're actually as a country concerned about it, we either need to do something holistic or at the very least start approaching it from different angles. And it's been pretty slow in my opinion.
Yeah, I mean, it definitely has been slow. I think that's an understatement. But let's go back to the bills pending right now, because I think you mentioned that there's a Republican sponsor and there's a Democratic sponsor. Now, correct me if I'm wrong. The Republican sponsor is a very moderate guy, right? Dr. Bill Cassidy, isn't he one of the sponsors?
So on this particular bill, the two primary sponsors are Senator Cantwell. So she leads the Senate Commerce Committee, and then Congresswoman McMorris Rodgers. She leads the House Energy Committee. That was who the genesis of the last discussion draft was. But there has been, to your point, on a few other privacy bills that were successful this year. So like, for instance, we had the Protecting Americans' Data from Foreign Adversaries Act. That did pass, actually. Even if you disagreed with the substance, and it did get a little pushback because the definitions are pretty broad, like around sensitive data, and it gives the FTC a ton of authority. But the notion of like, as a principal, do you want to be the person to say like, hey, no, I didn't want to restrict data going to China that's super sensitive on Americans? So that passed, and it actually is very similar to the EO. So like that, I would be curious to see any of your future conversations around that. At the very least, we have one privacy bill in 2024.
So it was a rider. More. So it was kind of a rider, right?
Yeah, I think it's fair. It's a niche focus. Like, you know, it's the same time they did the TikTok ban, or I shouldn't call it that, but essentially that's what it was.
Okay. But so who are the sponsors? So there's a bill on the Senate side, though. So who sponsored that?
Surprisingly, there's actually a number of attempts at comprehensive legislation out there. However, some of them are just by like one sponsor, or some have a couple and aren't as prominent. So for instance, like Senator Schatz has had a pretty good leading bill. Senator Cantwell actually had her own bill for a long time. So there are a lot of standalone comprehensive bills, but yeah, this one is a little unique in the sense that it's two chambers and two parties. And I think that's where people thought this may have the potential move. I say that all to say, though, there are other efforts out there. For instance, like the Kids Online Safety Act, that is a privacy bill, and that has well over 50 co-sponsors in the Senate side. So that is a privacy bill. It's just targeted specifically at kids and their safety and their privacy online. I mean, there are some substantive cons to it. And I think the members that are not supportive of it, or the reason you may not see it fully progress, is because of some of the underlying, you know, issues that people bring up. You know, one is around like age verification. Yes, it doesn't directly call for it, but that's the concern, is like, would you have a requirement to verify, you know, users' age? And if you do, you know, is there a, you know, a data security concern around that in terms of who is actually getting that data?
Yeah.
You know, would you want to send it directly to the company you're concerned about, especially if there is like a Chinese nexus or, you know, a foreign adversary nexus, let's say?
But I'm going, probably not.
Exactly.
Probably not.
So not saying that that's what that's requiring, but there is some version of like verifying people's age is very likely. Yes, there's third party providers that, you know, are neutral, but that is an issue there. I think the other issue is like, should we just focus on kids' privacy, or should we care about the privacy and security of all Americans' data? And that would be the argument, I think, of doing a comprehensive law. And we did see some members actually raise that argument recently.
I want to pivot over. We'll call this segment Stating the Obvious. So let's just explain to people who don't know anything about this, why this is not really a concern in a place like China or Russia. Why aren't they thinking about this?
Well, I guess I have two reasons. On one side of it, it's because, you know, both of those countries, especially China, it's really their quest to collect as much data as they can as a government on their own citizens, not just living in country, but also those citizens living abroad, as well as just people that disagree with them. So they rely on a surveillance system, and data is what fuels that. And Americans, unfortunately, are no exception to that. Some may downplay whether the average American's implicated, but I would push back against that. You know, China is very good at being a leader from a messaging and a policy standpoint. I mean, they're putting themselves out there on the AI front as helping develop norms around AI, and they've done the same around privacy. You know, China has a privacy law. The United States does not. Whether the Chinese government and Chinese companies actually follow that is a different question. But on paper, they have one. And it actually resembles and carries over some elements from the GDPR in the EU. So on one hand, and I can't take credit for this, but you actually have two economies. On one hand, you have the actual state collecting as much data as they can. But on the other hand, they're taking actions to restrict foreign companies from collecting and, you know, using data on Chinese citizens.
You can't use TikTok in China, right? I mean, they don't allow American social media or even their own social media companies to operate in country.
Well, you're right. That's the irony is the offerings of different apps is much different than it is in the U.S. And, you know, it's funny because when you saw certain apps being talked about in their national security nexus here, at least publicly, the reason for them not being offered in China sometimes is around the harm and the lack of value to like the own to Chinese citizens. Whereas we come at it from more of a national security angle versus a kid safety and security angle. So the challenge is, though, is like, how do you balance all of this? You know, one hand, you want Americans to be able to choose what apps they use and like, you know, make them aware of risks and threats and then empower them. Like that is the nice thing that separates us from China is, you know, we have a lot of freedom and a lot of choice that, you know, people in other countries do not have. So I am sympathetic to that being the counter argument in terms of taking a more aggressive stance. But there are some, obviously, I'm not saying that as a con for some of the recent actions, because there are some large national security questions in some apps. So that is the difference, I guess.
Let's talk about solutions. Let's take the bills out of the picture. What do you think might be some solutions for what is clearly a serious national security concern in terms of our data making its way into the hands of bad actors?
Yeah, I mean, outside of legislation, which I do think is probably the number one action, I would say like consumers shouldn't see this as a lost cause. I think there's that temptation to say it's all out there or there's new hope. If you're a consumer, I think you really should be owning this. Think about who you're sharing your data with in the very first place. Like, do you actually need to give up your data for a given service? And I have to admit, I sometimes am bad at that myself. Obviously, like you said, I'm not speaking for the DoD, but I'm still in the Army. You know, sometimes I will volunteer to give up my, you know, for a discount. However, the flip side of that is, who's now having access to that? That is the type of question the average person should be thinking. Do I actually need to give this data up in the first place? Like, and too oftentimes, data is way over collected. Like, there are very legitimate purposes. I would hate to see those unduly burdened, but do we need it? Second is like related to that is there are steps you can take. The constant notifications you get around opt-in, opt-out, they may seem annoying, but I would give serious thoughts in terms of, are you allowing, you know, certain types of data to use? Does an app on your phone need to track you and utilize your data? Do you want to voluntarily limit the way that advertisers are following you? Some of these decisions are in your hands now. On the inverse of that, though, is if you're a company, you shouldn't be sitting back waiting for there to be a law. My advice to any company is that they should be proactive and serious when it comes to privacy. We've seen a number of companies actually use this as a differentiator and as a competitive market advantage. I think it is. If we're serious about people's privacy, then we should be doing it as a company. And to their credit, a lot of big companies have actually been proactive. And there's been a lot of best practices that have come out of some of the bigger companies that now smaller and medium-sized companies have adopted and have led to more structural changes. So I think that's something to see, like how industry can be actually looked to and incentivized to be the leader in this space rather than being forced to. And obviously there is just a compliance reality to that. Most companies are operating in multiple jurisdictions, including the EU. So if you're already following the EU, does it make sense just to have your entire business model revolve around privacy and compliance rather than just segmenting a portion off? But some companies don't operate, you know, abroad. So maybe look to how can you implement privacy even if you don't have to? That's kind of two instant thoughts that come to mind, but I would say don't ignore the basics. Data collection is really important in use, but adversaries are going to go after it many other ways. So we can't neglect the basics when it comes to data security and cybersecurity and just making sure our defenses are as strong as they can be and really implemented from the start. I know security by design and secure by default are the buzzwords these days, but there are some really good substance there and really seeing how can we protect both our products as well as our, you know, our systems from the start and then evolving, because adversaries are going to continue to exploit that. So we can't neglect some of the basics, which unfortunately we do.
Do any of these bills feature a plan to roll out education on this topic? And is there room for education here? We do live in a country where we have freedom of thought, freedom of choice, but you have to have information in order to make an informed choice. You know, I'll have a relative, you know, I think of my father when he was elderly and he was a scientist. And I think it's often hard for people who aren't good with technology, even if they're brilliant at something else, just to figure out how to manage what they're giving over. And I feel like there's a big element missing here that's education. And I don't know who would sponsor that and what it would look like, but I know that they do that in Finland and they start young. So is any of this going to tackle this concern about just helping people understand, how do I reject cookies? How do I protect my data?
Among civil society, there are some awesome organizations doing work in that space, specifically on privacy, and then the cyber side as well, like Craig Newmark's Cyber Civil Defense Initiative and a lot of his orgs helping the average consumer in the cyber side. So there is work being done among civil society, but I think there's a significant amount to do, because to your point, you know, we just went through a lot of proactive measures people can do, but if they don't know how to do them and then take that added step, does it actually matter if they exist? I mean, I always go back to multi-factor authentication on the cyber side. It's super easy to do. And we always hear about these statistics, and maybe we can disagree if this is actually accurate, but it'll prevent 99% of like the security breaches. Okay, even if it's not 99%, it's 60%. It takes 5 seconds to implement. Why not do it? The same thing on the privacy side. There are some common sense privacy practices now that people just aren't doing, and we need to tell them. So I do think like there needs to be a more effective, you know, campaign out there to tell people the basics around privacy, just like what we're doing on the cyber side. It's happening, but I think it's small. I'd also look, you know, I come from a K-12 education background, you know, as an elected official for a long time. And, you know, is there a role for schools on the curriculum side? They're just getting there with cybersecurity curriculum and teaching cybersecurity best practices. What can be done on the privacy side, especially considering, you know, this technology is in the classroom now? Post-COVID, it's hard to find school districts that are not utilizing some sort of technology. So let's teach them to have good privacy and cyber hygiene from the very start. So that way, when they're an adult, they're not learning it for the first time.
Let's do some predictions now, because we're coming to the end of the cast. What do you predict will happen with respect to any legislation or resolution to this national security, bulk data, privacy concern that is really far bigger than the average Joe really recognizes?
Well, I think the most immediate is the Department of Justice is going to continue to work on their rulemaking around the executive order. So that's something, if anybody is around data sales or data flows abroad, that's something to be following. In terms of the legislative front, I think people should be engaging right now on this legislation. If you have concerns with it or you love parts about it, like, I'd flag those. I think that's more productive than some of the groups that just come out overtly opposed to it. Like, do I think it's perfect? No, but like, how can we make it better? There is still time. There's a significant road ahead for it, but it is possible for that law to pass for sure. And, you know, it's important to keep the momentum up. I think states are going to continue to act. Yes, legislative seasons in states are now winding down. Many have kind of closed their doors for the year until next year. But that's something to be mindful of. And the fourth is just more niche efforts. I think we'll continue to see efforts around kids' privacy, maybe some of the more niche national security concerns around data. And I would put AI there as well. The AI and privacy nexus cannot be forgotten. That's going to be a continual focus area, I think, among Congress as well as federal regulators, especially with the White House's executive order on AI. You know, privacy is an aspect of that and something to be on the lookout for. It's probably a lot to be in the mindful of 2024, but I don't see privacy going away. I think it's one of those issues. I can't think of a member of Congress that I've heard that does not want action on privacy. I think they may disagree on certain, and any federal policymaker for that matter, they may disagree on the substance of that and how we kind of strike a balance and compromise. But in terms of the end state, the average American cares about their privacy, and polls after poll show that, and so do policymakers. It's just a matter of trying to actually come together and move this forward so we're not here in another 10 years talking about this.
All right. Well, it's super fun talking to you, but we need to watch this stuff because I have a sense that there's going to be a lot more to come. So you would have to come back and visit us again. You can also track this stuff just for your information. You should know this, but you can get it on, what is it, congress.gov, and then there's GovTrack. I think that might be a .org. But you can also follow these things along. You can search them. Congress even has an app.
Exactly.
I guess they're collecting your data. So, you can do that if you want to follow these bills and it's something that you're interested in. You don't normally do it. This is probably a good time to start. Do you have any upcoming events you'd like to tell us about right now? Is there anything people can tune into to hear more Brandon Pugh?
Yeah, if you haven't been sick of me after this hour, there actually is. I have the next week I'm doing a joint program around more on the cyber side of the house, but I'll be on a panel with CISA and with the Deputy Assistant Secretaries of State from state, and then Ann Neuberger is kind of opening up for the day. So that's next week in DC. At the end of the month, actually on the Hill, I'm doing a privacy and AI event looking at how the two converge. And then for those who are going to be at Black Hat, I have the keynote address around the nexus between cyber and AI. That's not until August, then DEF CON. So, but then I love to write. So to the extent this stuff interests you, my team and I are writing a few times a week on these issues and related issues. So, and the nexus between cyber and privacy is really our sweet spot, where we spend a ton of time. So we kind of just got into the weeds a little bit today, but we always are exploring it. And I obviously have to just plug the standing committee. I guess monthly programs as well as their conference every fall are truly exceptional. So every once in a while I come out to those programs. I'd love to say hi to you there.
Oh, and speaking of upcoming events, the committee is having a luncheon on June 28th with Professor Harold Koh. By the way, you've got to see this guy. He is just brilliant. He's very thoughtful. He's also just a positive, fun guy to be around. But he's going to speak on the National Security Constitution in the 21st century, which is the same name as his new book. I assume this is going to be based on an article that I saw recently, which, by the way, I passed out to 100 people because it was so good and so thoughtful. But the way to find us so that you can register is at www.ambar.org/natsecurity. So you should totally come to this, and we will look forward to meeting you and seeing you when you do. Anyway, it's been great talking to you, and I'll look forward to talking to you again in the future. I wish you luck in your pursuits here.
Yeah, no, thanks for having me. Really enjoyed the conversation. Anytime.
All right. And thank you for listening to NSLT. Be sure to share this episode with a friend and to discuss any of the topics we've covered in a thoughtful way. Hear other people's opinions and arguments. It'll improve your skills as a lawyer. And remember, a key feature of our national security is our unity. In a country more diverse, not just in terms of skin color, but in thought, more diverse than any other country. Our writer and producer and host is me, Elisa Poteet. I'm always here in my individual capacity. Our editor and my co-producer is Francis Burkham. And my other co-producer is the ever lovely, ever amazing, the most hardworking woman in Washington, Holly McMahon, along with all the members of the Standing Committee on Law and National Security, without whom this podcast would not be possible. Thanks for listening.
The views expressed on National Security Law Today have not been approved by the House of Delegates or the Board of Governors of the American Bar Association, and this recording should not be construed as representing ABA policy.